Lacey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
It's One Day Monday, a one-day pledge drive here in WILL. We're being brief and to the point, but still need to reach a goal of 400 pledges today to support the next year of important information and intelligent conversation. We're almost halfway. 193 listeners have contributed more than $15,000 today. Have you? A dollar a week? A dollar a day? Determine the value and call 217-244-9455. Or log on to willpledge.org. Thanks.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us today. 40 years ago, on Christmas Eve 1968, the first color photographs of the Earth from space were taken by astronauts aboard Apollo 8. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is historian Robert Poole. He is the author of Earthrise, How Man First Saw the Earth. When Apollo 8 launched, the mission was talked about in terms of the nascent exploration of a new frontier. But Robert Poole notes that what happened is this. While Apollo 8 set out to discover a new world, the moon, it ended up rediscovering the old one, Earth. When the astronauts aboard Apollo 8 saw the Earth rise, they found the moment profound. In part, here's how Frank Borman spoke of it. It was the most beautiful, heart-catching sight of my life, one that sent a torrent of nostalgia, of sheer homesickness, surging through me. Bill Anders said this, "When I looked up and saw the Earth coming up on this very stark, beat-up lunar horizon, an Earth that was the only color that we could see, a very fragile-looking Earth, a very delicate-looking Earth, I was immediately overcome by the thought that here we came all this way to the moon, and yet the most significant thing we're seeing is our own home planet, the Earth." The photographs they made conveyed that same sense of beauty and fragility to us. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Robert Poole, is Reader in History, University of Cumbria. He has written and broadcast extensively on history. Earthrise, How Man First Saw the Earth, is published by the Yale University Press. And again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Robert Poole, it's so good to talk with you. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm very well, thank you. It's cold and sunny over here in northern England.
Okay, well, we've got some clouds moving in, but it's quite warm for this time of the year. We're approaching 60 degrees. So, well, now it is decades since Apollo 8. When we see the Earth from afar today, when we look at these images, how do they affect us? We now talk about globalization and how our world is becoming smaller.
Mm. Well, yes, it's really difficult to take ourselves back to a time when we really hadn't seen the Earth, when we didn't know what the Earth looked like. We see so many images of it in the newspapers and everywhere nowadays. The globe is just used as an advertising symbol. So its effect has perhaps worn off a little bit. But part of the power of it came back to me just recently, when, like many people in Britain, I was watching President Obama's inauguration. And one of the things that he said was, as the Earth grows smaller, so our common humanity appears more clearly to us. And he went on to say about how we have a duty not to waste and despoil the Earth, not to use more resources than we need. And I think It's all very well saying to people, you know, you mustn't waste things, you must look after the earth, and that was often being said in the 1960s. But I think until, for most people, until they actually saw that the earth really was small and limited, and there really wasn't anywhere else anywhere near that we could go to, it wasn't really possible until we'd seen the earth to think about it in that limited kind of way. It gave the environmental movement a real boost.
Yeah. So at once, great beauty, and yet these photographs that we'll talk about this afternoon conveyed also a sense of real fragility.
Mm. Yes, the astronauts, I think, understood that more than anybody. What we have to remember is that the Apollo program this was the second manned flight of the Apollo program, and there have been a lot of other manned space flights, but they'd all stayed in orbit. So they had these wonderful views that we're quite used to now of the curve of a large part of the Earth, but nobody had got away from the Earth and seen the whole Earth. We had a few photos, not terribly good quality, but nobody had seen the Earth by human eyes. And so the beauty of it was quite staggering. The thing about space is it's black. And the thing about the moon is that it's black and white and gray. There really isn't any color on the moon or in space except for the Earth itself. And that sheer difference was something the astronauts weren't quite prepared for. Also, from a spaceship, these Apollo craft are these tiny little conical capsules. They have five tiny windows. If anybody's ever tried to kind of see the moon out of an aircraft window or watch the sunset, that's hard enough, and there's plenty of windows on an aircraft. Mm. Five tiny windows in a capsule. The capsule is spinning slowly. They're probably not even pointing the right way. Astronauts reported it wasn't actually easy to see the Earth. You really had to look around, and then it would appear in a window for a moment and go, and they suddenly realized how small the Earth was, and they'd only gone a relatively small distance.
Yeah. You know, when we think of the Apollo program today, I suspect we think first of the mission that landed on the moon, Apollo 11. And you note that that mission has rather drowned out Apollo 8. Yet you also tell readers that Michael Collins, who was involved in both missions, thought Apollo 8 more significant. Why?
Well, I think he said something like that leaving the Earth is a more important historical moment than arriving at the moon. It's the leaving the Earth for the first time that's important. And he was thinking there partly of just, you know, like the frontier, the idea of a frontier exploration idea, leaving Europe, you know, leaving our homeland is the big step, almost no matter where you end up. But it was also that sight of the Earth that he was thinking of. And, of course, later, Michael Collins was he was the command module pilot. He was the man who was orbiting the moon while the other two walked on the surface. He had two or three days to wait for them to come back. He had plenty of time to look at the Earth and to think about it. And like all of those who had that extra time to think, he came away deeply impressed by the sight of the Earth. So, yeah, if the Apollo 11 astronauts feel that seeing the Earth was, you know, leaving the Earth and seeing it was a more important thing, I wouldn't argue. Pictures are fantastic.
Yeah. And something else to think about, or a few things to think about in terms of the significance of Apollo 8, it was a lunar orbiting mission rather than an Earth orbiting mission. So that's significant. And then the other thing that I found interesting that I hadn't realized, that you report that no manned mission subsequent to Apollo 8 has journeyed further from Earth, a quarter of a million miles away, and no mission traveled faster.
No, I mean, all the ones that went to the moon, you know, went to about the same distance and the same speed. But that was it. Others landed on the moon, but they all went the same distance away. And for the past, it's December 1972, is the last time any human being left Earth orbit. Now, that's one of these little party questions you can ask people. Mm-hmm. When was the last time anybody left Earth orbit? And a lot of people don't realize that it was, 36, 37 years ago now, that the space age is part of history. And at the time, and for quite a long time afterwards, we thought of the space age as pretty much the future. But now, I'm teaching students who weren't born at the time. You know, I'm probably teaching the children of people who weren't born at the time, actually. The space age is very much part of history. And historians like me, whose first interest is history and whose second interest is space. I started to come back and see the whole experience differently and ask these human cultural questions about it.
Hmm. What led you to explore this facet of America's space program, this story of history?
What led me? I was 11 when Apollo 8 went up and 12 when they landed on the moon. I've even got a little photograph, of, like many people have, of myself in the middle of the night. It was 3 a.m. In the UK when the astronauts got out and landed on the moon. But I followed the space program in the mid to late 60s, so I've got that in my genes, if you like. Also, I've always been a bit interested in science fiction. I like the ideas. And one of the films I was interested in was the film 2001: A Space Odyssey, which many of your listeners will know. And that was the biggest grossing film of all time, very influential. And right at the end of that, there is a shot of an astronaut who's kind of symbolically turned into a baby. He's kind of, you know, the human race is in its infancy, we're supposed to understand. And this baby, this embryo, looks back at the Earth, gazes at the Earth, and then turns around to look at us. And that image of the kind of human race looking at the Earth was released 8 months before Apollo 8 left the Earth. The Apollo 8 astronauts themselves were said to have actually attended a special screening of it in Houston. And I think they made, you know, an odd comment that it on the way that it reminded them of 2001. And I just thought, well, you know, here was this visionary film director imagining man looking at the Earth. Then a few months later, the real thing happened. You know, science fiction and science fact were that close. And I was interested in how these two were connected.
Yeah. I wonder, how did Clark and Kubrick think about what they had done in their film after seeing these photographs from Apollo 8?
That's an interesting one. I'm not sure how they would have felt after the film. Both Clark and Kubrick were very much future-centered. They believed that the humanity's future was in outer space, that as soon as we went into orbit, that was it. We'd now made that great step into space, and we were never going to come back any more than, you know, the pioneer settlers who came across the Atlantic would see America and think, very nice, but we're going to go home. It was assumed that the exploration would go on forever until we filled up the available space and then went on to the next frontier. People were very future-orientated. And that's the idea that you get from the film. But Arthur Clarke in particular also had this kind of nostalgic theme in his science fiction. He imagined astronauts and space settlers in the future looking back at the Earth and feeling really nostalgic. And it was that sort of visionary, that other part of Clarke's vision that was, for me, the most striking thing about Apollo 8. Leaving home has a mixture of, you know, going out, looking forward, but also looking over your shoulder, looking back.
Hmm. We should also mention that Clark's creation, HAL, took form here in Urbana at the University of Illinois, the computer.
Yes, yeah. And of course Manchester, not very far from me, was also one of the great early centers of computing. And the British Interplanetary Society tested a few firework rockets near Manchester and came foul of the firework laws as well. So we can claim that this part of England has an early part in the space program.
Hmm. How many people had imagined, and this is, of course, a hugely speculative kind of question, but how long ago had humans begun to imagine how Earth would appear from space?
Well, in the 20s, even the end of the 19th century, there were a few visionaries, people like Jules Verne, the science fiction writer, and Tsiolkovsky, the Russian space visionary, and a few others had kind of tried to imagine what it would look like physically, really, going out and looking at the Earth. And a few scientists and the odd environmental thinker would try to imagine the Earth looking like a wonderful garden floating in space. But, you know, in the middle of the 19th century, the trail goes a little bit cold. Right back through the Enlightenment, people didn't really think about what the Earth would look like. They were kind of outwardly focused. Even in the Middle Ages, people didn't really think of the Earth as a sort of separate planet at all. They envisioned it as a kind of, you know, a sort of the bottom part of creation, almost more like the bottom of a hole than something out in space. But if you go right through the Middle Ages, back to the classical period, you have ancient Greek and Roman thinkers imagining. Usually they tell you there was a dream. They don't even have a balloon flight or a magical journey. They say, I dreamed. And as I dreamed, my soul left my body. I went out. I saw the earth from a distance. And what they see is tiny little people scurrying like ants. And what occurs to them is the humility of mankind as part of creation, how small the earth is, how insignificant, how these little boundaries that people fight over are invisible from space, how the territories look so small. And they're seen as the vanity of human beings in the face of the cosmos. And very interestingly, many of the Apollo astronauts had very similar thoughts. How small we are. Why do we fight over these boundaries? You know, there are so many things that connect us. Why do we bother with our squabbles don't look very important.
Yeah.
And those people who've seen that wonderful recent film In the Shadow of the Moon, you can hear astronauts now looking back and saying very much the same sort of thing.
Yeah. I've got a listener who's ready to talk with us and would like to talk with you. He's calling in this afternoon from Geneva, Illinois. Line 4, good afternoon. You're on the air with Robert Poole.
Yeah, good afternoon. Great topic. My father-in-law used to work for NASA. He worked for NASA for years on the space shuttle program, the development of X-15. And I was fortunate enough to get hold of some of the first photographs taken from some of the space shuttles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very amazing pictures. And then now the ones that you get back, and I've subscribed to NASA TV. Some of the stuff they throw out there, HD and digital, is just amazing. And it's just, especially off some of the pictures that have been taken from Mars and the Hubble telescope. Man, I hope we can keep that kind of stuff up. It's just amazing what we can come up with.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the NASA website because it is fantastic. It's almost so big that you can hardly find your way around it. But if you find your way to NASA.gov, I think it is, the pictures are absolutely astonishing. The interesting thing about there is actually a bank on the NASA. There's great photos, and people can go and see the NASA photos of Earth. And there's a whole – you can actually, if you find your way through to it, you can see all the photos of Earth as well. But I agree with you that the visual side of things, actually seeing the Earth, is so important, not just for the astronauts, but it's something that everybody can get some idea of. But of course, I expect your father would have talked to the space shuttle astronauts as well, and I guess they probably all said you really had to be there.
Does the caller have a follow-up?
Yes, I do. I got some of the older pictures, too, that I have of the first moon launches from Apollo. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of those, and that's why I say compare the two. It's just amazing. I have one picture where the moon, and I think it's been shown a couple of times just recently, actually, where the astronauts are standing on the moon, and they're looking out, and the moon's just a click above the way the Earth is. It's not a direct line, but you could see it's kind of like a half a moon, except a half a Earth. It's just amazing. That was pretty eerie, pretty amazing how far away it is, you know. And these guys in a small capsule from years ago. I mean, that whole photography is just amazing. But I'm looking forward to the next generation of spacecraft. I know since we're in a decline right now in a lot of things, I hope they never give it up. I think the research and development that NASA has come forth with is in both the space shuttle program and the space station and some of the Hubble and other the pictures, and we can find things out there that we never knew. We're kind of rewriting the history books as I speak. But anyway, I'll get off. This is a good program. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. You want to follow up, Mr. Poole?
Well, just to say that often when you do cutting-edge research like that, the most important results are often what you don't expect to find out. And NASA never had in its mind to begin with the importance of looking at the Earth. They considered it as just kind of touristy shots. The engineers, the mission planners weren't really very interested. But the historical consensus has become that one of the most important results of the space program was actually those photographs of the Earth. And if we do get manned missions to Mars, or for that matter, some of the pictures from the unmanned missions. You know, I wonder what like the Earth would look like as a bright star like Venus in the Martian atmosphere, and what that would tell us.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Robert Poole, author of Earthrise: How Man First Saw the Earth. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, when were those photographs made by the Apollo 8 astronauts first seen by the world? They were not seen on Christmas Eve or on Christmas Day. Tell us the story.
Well, the story was, of course, that there were no digital photographs in those days, or at least they were in a very primitive state. And the astronauts took these marvelous Hasselblad cameras, which have been specially adapted for use in space, and they took large negatives of superbly high quality. And the film was flown back to Earth with the astronauts, and when the divers picked them up out of the ocean, the first thing they were given was the bag of film. Then, after that, they took the astronauts, and the film was taken back to the aircraft carrier, helicoptered back to NASA headquarters in Houston. And Dick Underwood, the director of photography, and others would then spend all night and all the next day very, very carefully developing these photographs. You know, each negative was the only one. They absolutely got it right. They could have put them through a machine, but they decided to do each one by hand. And Dick Underwood has talked about how he actually saw, the image coming out on the very first print of Earth rising over the moon. And they were then printed in large numbers in color and physically released and handed to the press with a caption printed on the back. So they didn't instantly appear all around the world.
It's interesting. A couple of things come to mind here. First, Robert Underwood, I wonder what it was like to be in the dark room. These are days when we don't, as you mentioned, don't have digital. We're in the dark room working with developer, and you literally see the image begin to take shape on photographic paper. Has Robert Underwood, did he talk about what that was like for him to see the impact, or see the image coming up in the dark room?
Yeah. His name was Dick Underwood, and he talked having it in his hands and watching it appear as the image came out. And he had spent a lot of time. He behind the scenes had persuaded the mission planners to allow a little bit of extra space for photography. And he'd got a very good personal relationship with the astronauts. So although photos of the Earth were at the absolute bottom of their priorities, it was just a list of miscellaneous photos, targets of opportunity. The photos of Earth weren't on the mission list. But he got on with the astronauts, and they said, "Yeah, we'll take some great photographs for you." They understood that it was important. And actually taking these photos for the astronauts gave them a little bit of freedom, a bit of independence. It was something really great that they could do outside the normal routine. So there was a human side to the space program as well. But for a lot of the time, it was strictly unofficial until eventually NASA woke up to the importance of these photos. And then it was given a bit more emphasis in the mission plan.
Yeah. When did NASA become aware of the power of this particular photograph, Earthrise? It wasn't immediately known as Earthrise, but what was the reaction of NASA when agency officials saw the photo and saw the reaction, the public's reaction to the photo?
Well, that particular photo wasn't called Earthrise. They put a very technical caption on the back of it. And I think NASA at the time was still thinking of it very much as a photograph that showed that we were on our way out into space. Here is the Earth, it's a planet. And we can tell it's a planet because it's over the top of another planet, which is the moon. And you can think of it two ways, and there will be still perhaps many people who think of it. That's our goodbye photograph to Earth. That's our going out in space photograph. That's the one that shows us that the Earth is one planet amongst many. But as we got more and more of these photos, and as they became so, they were given such great emphasis when, for example, Life and the Colour magazines came out a week or two later, the photos of the Earth were very prominent. The idea of the Earth as a home, this sort of sense of the astronauts' nostalgia, I think took over. And eventually NASA was persuaded that these photos of the Earth were one of the best public relations things they had, because it encouraged people to support Earth satellite, Earth photography, Earth mapping, and environmental uses for satellites as well. There's a very nice story, just to backtrack a few years. After the first spacewalk on one of the Gemini missions in spring of 1965, we got the first photos that were taken from outside a capsule from a spacewalk, no window, just the camera and the Earth. And there were some stunning pictures of this beautiful blue curved planet. And as they'd been developed and were laid out on the tables the next day for the mission planners and the astronauts to look at, one of the top mission planners, the head of manned space flight, I think it was down one end of the table looking at the photographs of the spaceship and the hardware and so forth. And Dick Underwood was down the other end of the table, and he said, "Come over here, Mr. Gilruth, and look at these pictures." And Mr. Gilruth came down and he said, "Those are just pictures of the Earth." And Underwood said, "Yes, but look what you can see." And he showed him, you know, how much they meant. And Gilruth said, "Yeah, I see now. From now on, your job is to take me great pictures of the Earth." But although Underwood had the backing from the top there, he still had to battle the mission planners. It took several years before NASA finally realized, and from about Apollo 14, 15 onwards, the late missions, they took special cameras and put a lot more emphasis on the photography of the Earth.
Let's take another call. A listener in Vermilion County on line 4. Good afternoon.
I was wondering why he hasn't mentioned that the Earth is not quite round, and we know that from the burial grounds in Ireland that were built 5,000 years ago, where the burial tunnel on Solus Day, the sunlight shines in.
Mm. Yes, these ancient buildings, I don't know too much about them, but I mean, I've been to one or two of these, not in Ireland, but in Orkney in the north of Scotland, and it is astonishing how the light shines right down them at the right moment. I don't think you necessarily need to assume that the ancient builders of them knew that the Earth was not round. I mean, they took an awful lot of trouble to line things up. But it does show that they had a very clear sense of where the Earth was in creation, where they were in creation. And that comes, if you ever get lucky enough to visit one of these, this comes through very much. And, you know, it took thousands of years for us to get a very much better sense than that when we actually got out and saw the Earth. So, yeah, I agree. That's quite something.
There was others built that are all wrong. The Egyptians knew it, but the ones in Maine and in Japan that were built, in the 1800s, and they're are not correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I guess it's very difficult to get these things wrong, but I think you're probably the expert on these things.
Well, I've been there. Yeah, they're really fascinating.
Thank you.
Enjoyable program.
Thank you for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Robert Poole, author of Earthrise, How Man First Saw the Earth. Well, what were NASA's objectives for Apollo 8?
Well, very simply, to get to the moon before the decade is out. That was the target that John F. Kennedy had set them in 1961. And that dictated the speed, the scale, the pace, the whole nature of the space program. So it was a race to the moon, but the moon turned out to be a dead rock. And it was this kind of irony that people came to the moon and the Earth seemed to be the only living thing in space. It looks alive. It was the irony of that that emerged quite, for me, you know, was one of the most important things to emerge from the NASA missions. Another thing that was related to the way that the moon programs happened was that because they wanted to go straight to the moon, they didn't go through the space, building a space station in orbit phase. They just went straight for the moon the quickest possible way, which meant that we didn't have a long-term legacy of the space program. And it also meant that all of the space probes went off in an equatorial orbit. That is, they went off in a horizontal orbit, pretty much parallel with the equator. And more recent space probes have gone around the poles, sort of going around the top and the bottom of the Earth. And in some ways, that's more interesting and more useful for science, for looking at the poles and the whole range of climate and landscape within the Earth. And there is a wonderful little Japanese space probe called Kaguya, which means Selene. It's the Greek word for moon. And if people Google Kaguya, you can see the photograph, in fact, the high-definition film that the Kaguya probe took of the Earth rising over the moon, over the north pole of the moon. And it's a perfectly round Earth for that reason. The Apollos always took the Earth, you know, that was only about two-thirds there. The Japanese have got a perfectly full round Earth rising exactly over the pole.
And these photographs that are being made today, what kinds of practical uses are they being put to?
I mean, the distant photographs of the Earth, or
like the photographs that Kaguya is responsible for.
The Kaguya probe is there to map the moon and to find out information about the moon. It's a Japanese scientific probe. But it is interesting that they took enormous trouble to put the probe in exactly the right orbit and have the cameras that we're pointing exactly the right way on exactly the right Earth rise to get this full Earth rise. And I think it's enormously important to the Japanese to get just the right picture at just the right moment. It reminds me of the Japanese haiku, the poem that describes in a few words the perfect moment. And the Japanese photo is a kind of a sort of haiku in space, if you like. And I think it shows just how important the legacy of Apollo 8 was, how much the impact of that photo is appreciated in Japan, and how they're going for an artistic payoff for the moon probe, as well as just the scientific one.
Well, tell us about how and to what extent these photos affected the advent of the environmental movement, Apollo 8's photos.
Well, that's quite a question. I mean, you know, as soon as the Earth became visible, it had friends. Friends of the Earth was founded in 1969, just after we could see the Earth. But very early on, there were one or two early biologists and scientific thinkers who, looking at the Earth, had a sense that the Earth was alive. And there was a guy called John McConnell as well, who was a kind of universalist, internationalist thinker, a Quaker, a peace activist. And McConnell, seeing the Earth photos from Apollo, was quite deeply affected, as were other people, and contacted NASA and got permission to use it on an Earth flag. And he distributed these large, quite sizable cotton flags at the Moonwatch in Central Park, New York, in July 1969, when people gathered to watch the moon landings. He distributed this Earth flag, which was meant to be an internationalist flag, a kind of sign of peace and togetherness and brotherhood. And the year after that, in the spring of 1970, he started the first Earth Day, using this Earth flag as the symbol of Earth Day. And, of course, Earth Day, when I was in the States, we don't have it on calendars in the UK, but I noticed that Earth Day in the spring is a regular thing on calendars in the US now. So the Earth Day Environmental Festival was a direct result of seeing the Earth from space. The other thing that happened was the well-known at the time, the Whole Earth Catalogue, which was a kind of catalogue of environmental. It's a wonderfully Californian mixture of environmental things, hippie things, and high-tech things. But it was all to do with the Earth and sustainability and being aware of the Earth and space and mankind's place in the world. And the Whole Earth Catalogue ended up selling nearly a million copies. And it had on the front of it this image of the whole Earth, various Apollo images of the whole Earth. And in fact, the creator of the Whole Earth Catalogue, Stuart Brand, who's quite well known from various things now, had actually campaigned in the mid-60s for some of the earlier space probes that were going around the moon to take a photo of the Earth from the moon, even before the astronauts went there. And if listeners would like to have a look at the Earthrise website, there's a link right through from the WIL website. You can see that first black and white photograph of the Earth rising over the moon. So when Stuart Brand put the Earthrise photo or the Earth photo on the front of the Whole Earth Catalogue, it was a kind of trophy. He kind of felt, I helped do that. So in a way, you know, early environmentalists actually helped get the photos of the Earth as well.
Yeah. And then 4 years after Apollo 8, we have Apollo 17 and the photograph, the image that has come to be known as Blue Marble. Most widely reproduced image in history.
Quite likely, yes. I mean, it's often said, and it's never been sort of contradicted, it's so widely reproduced. I mean, of course, all of NASA's photographs are free, for any reasonable use anyway,
yeah.
which makes them very widely reproduced. But people don't realize that. I think Al Gore has said this. He uses it in his environmental talks and film about the Earth. That, you know, nearly all the time when you see a photo of the whole Earth, it's the one that was taken by Apollo 17. Because Apollo 17, very unusually, it was launched at night, and as it was leaving the Earth, it was leaving from the equator in the middle of the day, just below the equator, in fact, and it had the sun right behind it. The moon would have been completely dark as seen from the Earth, and looking back, it got the full Earth. And Dick Underwood, the Apollo director of photography, knew that this was coming and trained the astronauts in photography to make sure they got that superb photo of the receding Earth as they boosted away from it. When they came back, you know, the Earth would have changed. It would have lost a bit of its full curve, its full disk. So that full photo, it's like a kind of... they say that the most common type of painted picture in history is the full-face portrait. And what you have there is a full-face portrait of the Earth, or as it became known, Gaia. The whole Earth was given the name Gaia by the environmentalist and space scientist James Lovelock, who came up with a whole theory about the living Earth to back it up. So, yeah, we got a full-face portrait of Gaia at the very end of the Apollo program.
Hmm. In the end, you say the photos from space have been both a trophy and a liability. How have they affected the space program long-term?
Interesting question. In a way, the mission to the moon was a dead end. Once you'd done the moon, come back with your rocks, there was no space station left in Earth orbit. We didn't have the stepping stone. We went there the quick way. But certainly by the end of the Apollo program, when that wonderful picture of the whole Earth, the blue marble, was brought back, attention had shifted back to earthly things. We'd had the early Environmental Protection Acts, the Environmental Protection Agency, the environmental movement had taken off, and concern was much more in the early 70s about earthly problems rather than sort of thinking what part of space we were going to be in by 1979. It was a very different kind of decade, and in some ways the photographs of the Earth reinforced that sense. And it almost made the manned space program appear like a kind of 60s high-tech thing that we weren't doing anymore. And it took quite a few years for NASA to kind of reinvent a mission. The space shuttle never really performed the role that it was meant to, although it did great things. And it wasn't until 1990 that NASA really, really rethought and refocused itself around satellite technology for your observing the Earth. The land satellites went up, and it coined this phrase for 1990, mission to Earth. So in the end, the photographs of the Earth were an encouragement to NASA to actually refocus on the Earth, which is what the modern space program has now done.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Robert Poole, author of Earthrise, How Man First Saw the Earth. Let's take another call, a listener in Kankakee. Line 4, hi.
Howdy. Wonderful show. I just wanted to mention what I think is probably the next generation of amazing pictures of Earth. It was on the cover of National Geographic maybe two Decembers back of Saturn, and they had the sun, which was just this little spot in the distance. And then in the edge of the photograph, it's almost like it was a printing flaw. There's just this little speck, and that's the Earth.
Mm. Yes, the pale blue dot. The pale blue dot.
Pale blue is just a, like I said, it really looked like a printing flaw.
Mm. I wonder, what's your reaction to that pale blue dot photograph? What does it make you feel about the Earth?
The National Geographic one I'm speaking of?
Mm.
Or the Apollo one you've been
the National Geographic one, the pale blue dot.
I'd never seen anything so visually putting us in our place, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Stunning, for some though. People, it makes people think the Earth is just an insignificant planet. You know, there must be loads of little Earths out there.
Exactly.
For other people, it makes it seem like the Earth is even smaller, even more special, even more precious.
Both. Indeed.
Yeah. Interestingly, Carl Sagan, the astronomer who was very taken himself by the photographs of the Earth, was behind the first photograph of the Earth as a pale blue dot, which was taken in 1990 by one of the I think it was the Voyager probes that you know went right through the solar system and out. And when they finished taking photographs of the planets, he Carl Sagan managed to get it turned round to look back and take photographs of the little dot planets, including the Earth and Venus and so forth. And we got this pale blue dot photograph, and that was in a way Carl Sagan's gift, one of Carl Sagan's many gifts to posterity, this sense of the Earth as a tiny little dot. And Sagan actually wrote a book called Pale Blue Dot in which he meditated on the meaning of it. And part of Carl Sagan wanted to go out into space onwards forever, but probably a larger part of Carl Sagan wanted to look after the Earth. And he said, yeah, we are going to go out into space, but we need to get things straight on the Earth first. In the end, I think he was sort of hovering back to caring for the Earth before we did any more really big things in space.
Does the caller want to follow up? No. Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I want to ask you about another image that has been taken that features the Earth. This is an image of the Earth reflected in the spacesuit, in the headgear of astronaut.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about that image?
Well, the person that is Russell Schweikert, who was on Apollo 9, the one after Apollo 8. It did a lot of orbital missions testing out the lunar module. It never left Earth orbit. But Schweikert himself was left for 5 minutes while they sorted out a technical problem, just floating in space, doing a spacewalk. And he had this amazing experience then. His mind was flooded with thoughts about why he was out there, the only human, looking at the Earth. And, you know, he was nothing special, nothing important, yet he was having this amazing vision. And he wanted to communicate this, if you like, Earth consciousness to people back on Earth, and did so very, very effectively. And his words are often quoted. And amazingly, his colleague Dave Scott took a photograph of Schweikert doing his spacewalk with the Earth actually reflected in his helmet, almost as if, you know, that was what was on his mind. And I think that powerful image of the astronaut with their face in this dark reflected visor replaced by the Earth is a symbol for the powerful effect that seeing the Earth actually had on the astronauts. And a lot of them went on to have quite unusual careers. They became religious evangelicals, environmental apostles, or Edgar Mitchell was founded a foundation for new planetary consciousness, and so on. They were quite deeply affected by it. So I really love that image of the astronaut with the Earth reflected in the helmet.
Yeah, it's a marvelous image. Back to Apollo 8. In one of the broadcasts on Christmas Eve, the astronauts shared a passage from Genesis. How had they come to choose that message?
Well, the story behind that is quite extraordinary, because NASA had left it up to the astronauts themselves what to say when they broadcast from the moon to the biggest TV audience in history on Christmas Eve. I mean, you would think that they would script it very, very carefully. But they were happy to leave it to the astronauts, and the astronauts consulted a publicist who consulted a friend and so on. And they tried all sorts of things about one world and universal brotherhood and so forth. And then somebody hit on the idea that, no, just go back to basics. Read from the book of Genesis, which, of course, is Old Testament. It's very ancient writings. And something similar is at the root of many of the world's religions. And they simply read the first 10 verses of the creation story from the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he saw the earth, and he saw that it was good. And as those words were broadcast live on Christmas Eve, Christmas morning, was it, the photographs or the television black and white picture that they transmitted back of the Earth was actually on the newspapers, on the breakfast tables. So people were thinking of the Earth at the same time as they were hearing the Apollo astronauts read from the book of Genesis. It was almost like, you know, you were present at the moment of creation. As Frank Borman said, as he was leaving the Earth and looked out through the window, this must be what God sees. And I think that was a sort of unifying moment, a moment when people understood the space program was about a lot more than just the moon. It was about humanity, the universe, creation, God, religion, fundamentals, everything. Nobody had seen the Earth before, and there was no better way of bringing over the force of it than reading from the creation story.
Yeah. Let's take one last call this afternoon. Listener in Chicago, line 4. Hi.
Following through with your comments just now, we're called upon in scriptures to be stewards of the earth, and here our very life is being jeopardized due to our inconsiderate, almost euthanasia effects of our footprint upon the earth. And I just thought I'd add that to what you were just saying, that we ought to consider the earth as an oasis, at least, and in the universe, and for the, who knows what time in the future we have left, to still nurture it as much as we possibly can. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. What a nice way to wrap up. Robert Poole, do you want to comment?
Well, I agree with the caller completely. I mean, there is one Christian tradition that mankind was given dominion over all of nature and the animals, and there's another tradition that mankind was simply given stewardship and has to look after the earth. And I think seeing the earth and how fragile it was gave that tradition a boost, and that effect is still with us, and I'm very glad that it is.
Mm. Well, to go back to Genesis and part of the passage that the astronauts quoted, God saw that it was good. And if God sees it as good, you better take care of it, right? And there we have to leave it. Robert Poole, any last comment you'd like to make?
No, it's been a pleasure being on the program. And it's all very well listening to people talking about it. But if people would like to see some of the pictures and earlier still pictures, the first pictures of the Earth, they go to the Earthrise website, earthrise.org.uk. They can see them there and read a bit more about it.
Okay, very good. Robert Poole, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Poole is the author of Earthrise, How Man First Saw the Earth. The book is published by the Yale University Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in now from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Let's take a look at those numbers as they finished up in Chicago. At the CME Group's Board of Trade, futures in the wheat pit like this for the day, $5.65 the settlement price in the nearby March wheat contract with a high of 577 and a low at 556 and a quarter, settled 565, up 8 cents on the afternoon. May futures of 589 and three quarters the top, the low at 69, settled at 578, up 8. In July contract, the harvest month for the soft red at 602 on the high, the low at 582. Settlement price at 590 and a half, up 8 1/4 for the day. September wheat 626 and a quarter, the high, the low at 609. Settlement price up 8 1/4 cents at 615 1/4. March wheat in Kansas City 8.5 cents higher today at $5.95. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby March contract at 383 high, the low at 372 and a half, settled 377 and a half, up 1/4. May 399 the high, the low at 383. Settlement price of $3.88, a half cent higher. In July, futures 403.5, the high, the low at 393.5. Settled 398.5, up 0.75 cents. September contract 413 3/4, the high, the low at 404 3/4. Settlement price at 408 3/4, up 0.25 cents. December futures for 09. This is the new crop harvest month. Unchanged on the day, 427 the high, the low at 416 3/4. Settled the same today as it did Friday afternoon at $4.21 3/4. December corn unchanged for the afternoon. Related products, March crude oil is down 47 cents at this hour. Ethanol futures just about unchanged, and the RBOB gasoline there 0.2 cents lower for the RBOB. Now the soy complex and its products. March bean futures $10.19 the high, the low at 9.91 1/2. Settlement price at $10.02. May futures 10.24 the high, the low at 9.96 1/4. Settlement price 10.14 1/2, up 2 1/2. August contract 10.20 the high, the low at $9.98 3/4 cents, a penny lower at 10.04 for the August soybeans on the settlement price. And September futures 9.90 1/4 the high, the low at 9.69 3/4. Settlement price down 2 cents at $9.74. November beans 9.60 the high, the low at 9.35 3/4. Down 3 cents at 9.43 for the Novembers, off 3 in the bean pit. Related products now. March bean meal futures down $3.50, a high of $3.19.40, low at $310.50. Settlement price at $3.13.80, down $3.50 for the afternoon. May bean meal futures $3.16.60, the high, the low at $3.08.50, settled at $3.11.60, down $3. March bean oil futures $34.77, the high for the day, the low at $33.01. Settlement price at $34.23, up 83 cents in the May. Bean oil, 82 cents higher, $35.09 the high. The low at $33.39, settled $34.57, 82 cents higher on the day. It's One Day Monday here at the WILL radio stations, looking to finance with you some of the programming that you hear on this public radio station. As of this hour, 199 pledges have been received. We'd like to double that number before we get to the end of the day. Some $15,775 in the coffers, extra dollars in the coffer, to support all the types of programming that you hear on this public radio station. If you'd like to join those 199 on our way to 400, please do that now. The number to call is 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. Or if you're listening on the web, there's a great big red button over there on the side of the page at WILL.illinois.edu. It says Pledge Now. Go ahead and make your contribution. It's really quick, simple, and easy on the web or by phone at 217-244-9455, our One Day Fun Day Monday Pledge Drive. So please join us if you can. More numbers from the CME Group's Mercantile Exchange site in a moment, and then the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, when we'll talk with the folks at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
And let's take a look at the livestock prices and the contracts and how they fared today in Chicago. The cattle were higher on the day, while the lean hogs finished lower. February live cattle, 84.80 the high, 83.65 the low, 84.70 the settlement at up 105. April, 88 even the high, 86.65 the low, 87.75 the settlement at up 105. June, 85.17 and a half the high, 84.05 the low, 84.92 and a half the settlement at up 85. And August live cattle, 85.80 the high, 85 even the low, the settlement 85.72 and a half up 65. March feeder cattle, 95.80 the high, 94.50 the low, the settlement 95.55 up 120. April, 97.40 the high, 95.65 the low, the settlement 97.35, that up 182 and a half. May, 98.60 the high, 97.25 the low, 98.52 and a half the settlement, that up 127 and a half. August, $100.60 the high, the low 99.30, the settlement $100.50, that up 110. February lean hogs, 56.30 the high, 55.90 the low, the settlement 56.05, that down 30. April, 60.70 the high, 60 even the low, 60.07 and a half the settlement, that down 32 and a half. May, 72.60 the high, 72.05 the low, 72.55 the settlement, that down 10. June lean hogs finished up 10 today, 73.25 the high, 72.50 the low, 73.05 the settlement, that up 10. And February pork bellies, 79.50 the high, 77 even the low, the settlement 77.02 and a half, that down 197 and a half. The Dow is currently off 37 at 82.43. The NASDAQ off 8 at 15.84. The S&P 500 down 3 at 8.66. And crude oil in New York nearby month down 52 to 39.65. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Henry Frain is our technical director today. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. A wind advisory is in effect in far southern Illinois until 8 p.m. tonight. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. Windy and warmer across the two states. In Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms developing. In Indiana this afternoon, a mix of clouds and hazy sunshine. Highs ranging from 48 in northern Indiana to around 70 in the far south. Tonight, in western Illinois, showers and thunderstorms diminishing during the evening, then becoming partly cloudy. Elsewhere, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms. Lows tonight ranging from 42 in northwestern Illinois to 55 in the south. And the outlook for tomorrow, in northern sections and in